This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Christian Camargo. Today, we feature a talk delivered by Susie Snyder, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for her contributions to the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons. Those efforts include producing the report Don't Bank on the Bomb, the only global report profiling the companies that produce nuclear weapons and the institutions that finance them. The title of today's forum is Noble Ambitions, Nobel Prize. Introducing Ms. Snyder is Alita Tu, Associate Director and Board Co-Chair of the Barbara and Norman Tanner Center for Human Rights. Ms. Snyder's lecture was delivered on April 3, 2018. It was co-sponsored by the Tanner Center for Human Rights and the Utah Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. Here now, introducing Ms. Snyder, is Alita Tu.
Susie Snyder is the Managing Director of Don't Bank on the Bomb, a joint research and campaign effort of PAX Netherlands and ICANN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. Ms. Snyder has published numerous reports and articles, including Dealing with the Ban, The Rotterdam Blast, The Immediate Humanitarian Consequences of the 12-kiloton Nuclear Explosion, and Withdrawal Issues, What NATO Countries Say About the Future of Tactical Nuclear Weapons in Europe. She is an International Steering Committee member of the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize-winning International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. Ms. Snyder has also served as the Secretary General for the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom at their Geneva Secretariat. She was named Hero of Las Vegas in 2001 for her work with indigenous populations against U.S. nuclear weapons developing and nuclear waste dumping. Ms. Snyder currently lives in the Netherlands with her husband and son. Please join me in welcoming Ms. Snyder.
Thank you. So, hi, everybody. It is always so awkward to be introduced and to sit. So I'm sitting over there and I am blushing because, you know, I'm like, oh, yeah, I did those things. Yeah, it's true, you know, but sometimes I do a lot of things that are also like really boring. So, you know, life is not always what you expect. And like coming here to Salt Lake City, I honestly didn't ever really expect to come to Salt Lake City again. So it's extremely wonderful to be here. I mean, I'm here in the beautiful, not flat lands. And I'll tell you, the Netherlands is a great country, but it is below sea level. So if I get a little spacey, it's because I'm at elevation. And it's unusual. I'd say most, if not all, of my professional life, I've talked to people about nuclear issues. And a lot of that has been about nuclear weapons. And nuclear weapons are the worst weapon that was ever designed. The absolute worst weapon. Nuclear weapons were designed to destroy cities. Like, it's not, we don't, in our society, we don't often design something specifically to blow up a city with one bomb. But all nuclear weapons, that's what they're designed for. They're not designed for battlefield use. I mean, there were some at some times. At one time, there were nuclear landmines. Luckily, those are all gone. At one time, you know, there were nuclear depth charges. However, those are also all gone. What we have now is about 15,000, just under 15,000 nuclear weapons on the planet, each one of which could annihilate a city in a flash. Because that is what they are designed to do. Even the smallest nuclear weapon in any current arsenal would leave tens of thousands of civilians critically injured or dead. There's no possible use of nuclear weapons that would not violate the core principles of international humanitarian law. And here at Hinckley, I'm sure that, you know, every once in a while there's a good lecture talking about international humanitarian law. And with the Human Rights Center, this is fundamental in our global society. There are rules to war. You can't indiscriminately target civilians. It's not allowed. It hasn't been allowed for over 100 years, like 120 years. This fundamental principle has been part of our global society. And yes, it happens. But for the most part, it does not. And I think it's important to remember that. It's important to remember that the world changes. And things that happened 100 years ago are not happening today. Like, kids aren't working in factories today. Now are they? That's a pretty cool change. Women can vote. That's 100 years. That is a fundamental change in our society. And we do not indiscriminately target civilians in warfare. Even horrible dictatorial regimes are chastised in the global community for targeting civilians. And that is what nuclear weapons are designed to do. They are a weapon of mass destruction. And there's two other weapons of mass destruction. There are biological weapons. And since biblical times, biological weapons have been a no-no. You do not poison the well, right? You just don't do that. It's not appropriate, to put it mildly. Since 1972, biological weapons have been outlawed. And yes, here and there, there are little bits and little places where sometimes somebody develops or plays around with a biological weapon. But for the most part, they are shunned. Nobody brags about having biological weapons. Chemical weapons, the other weapon of mass destruction, they're pretty terrible. Again, going back 100 years, we learned some pretty strong lessons in the First World War. You can't poison people with gas. And coming out of that war, we made that illegal. You can't do that. It's not done. That was a partial prohibition on chemical weapons way back when, before the UN even. And in 1996, all chemical weapons were comprehensively prohibited. And all countries that have chemical weapons signed up, or not everybody signed up, a lot of them signed up to an international treaty that also gave them a plan on how to destroy the existing stockpiles and how to clean up the mess that creating those weapons left behind. And this is really important, especially here. And I know there are people in this community who have worked at Tooele, who have helped clean up, worked on the project, but then helped clean up after the production of chemical weapons, because you can move beyond, because society does move beyond weapons of mass destruction. And now, since 2017, there's a treaty on nuclear weapons. And it's not the first treaty on nuclear weapons. There are others. There's a treaty from 1963 that makes the use of nuclear weapons and the deployment of nuclear weapons into outer space illegal. This is a smart thing. Nobody wants to use nuclear weapons in space. It's one thing, I'm a big Star Wars and Star Trek fan. I do not discriminate. But the use of nuclear weapons does not allow for the further exploration of space. Let me tell you that. That was in 1963. In 1970, a treaty came into force that made nuclear weapons illegal for most countries, but not all. Because this treaty, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, had a little clause built in there that if you had tested nuclear weapons before 1967, you could hang on to them for a while you figured out a way to negotiate their verified elimination. So you could hang on to them for a bit. And there are five countries that we know for sure tested nuclear weapons before 1967. And it's China, France, Russia, back then it was the Soviet Union, the United States, and the United Kingdom. There are also questions about whether Israel and South Africa did a joint nuclear weapons test in the summer of 1967 in the Indian Ocean. But the technology at the time in the 60s, right? Big supercomputers that didn't have as much power as in my cell phone. Whether or not that test actually took place, we don't actually know, which is kind of a weird thing. So we don't know where South Africa and Israel would fit into this 1970 agreement. South Africa gave up its nuclear weapon program anyway in the 90s. South Africa said, you know what? Apartheid's over. We do not need the bomb in Africa. It's pretty cool. I like South Africa. South Africa does good things for disarmament. And the NPT has this bargain in it that if you have the weapons, you have to negotiate a way to get rid of them. And every other country that signed on to the NPT, and almost every other country in the world, with the exception of four, are part of this treaty, which is massive for international treaties. Like, it's not easy to get countries on board. It's hard to join a treaty. Every other country in the world said, no, we're not going to get our own nuclear weapons. And that's pretty cool, and that's held. And it's, for the most part, it has been very successful. And what everybody thought in 1962 and 1963 and 1965, there are going to be 30 and 40 and 50 countries that have nuclear weapons, didn't happen because of law, because of international law, because of the power of international treaties, because it changed the way people thought about nuclear weapons. It wasn't a way to buy into a special club anymore. It was a way to get ostracized. China, France joined this 1970 agreement only in the 90s. They came on board a little bit later, but the treaty still did its job and prevented most countries from getting nuclear weapons. India, Pakistan, North Korea, they slipped through. They have nuclear weapons as well. But that's not so many. That's 9 countries in the world that have nuclear weapons. And 9 out of 193 is tiny. And I think it's really important to think about that because I do a lot of work involving the United Nations. And international affairs is awesome because every country has the same rights, no matter how big or small they are. Now, this is really tricky if you're working, for example, with Jamaica that has 2 diplomats to cover 3 meetings at the exact same time. Or if you're working with the US that has 45 members on its delegation to those same meetings. Or if you're working with Japan, that has 90. Japan sends the biggest delegations to all nuclear weapons meetings. There's a whole bunch of theories about that. I won't get into it too much. So, you know, there's only 9 countries that have nuclear weapons, and that 5 of them have an agreement that they will, you know, they're legally obligated to negotiate disarmament. There's this thing, though. There's this kind of gap. Other countries said, wait a minute, we can't get them, but there's actually no law that makes them illegal for everyone overall. And that we're missing that. We have international law that says you can't test them. We have international law that says you can't deploy them in Antarctica. We have regional zones, regional treaties that say you can't have nuclear weapons in the region. We need something for the world. And so in 2017, countries negotiated, 135 countries came together at the UN, and they negotiated a new treaty. And it's visionary, because all treaties in the time, if you read the preamble of any treaty, it gives you this beautiful snapshot of the hope and ambition of those in the room negotiating it at the time. The preamble of every treaty sets out a vision. And the preamble on the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons sets out a vision and recognizes that the risk of nuclear weapons has not gone away. In fact, in 2017, they said it was higher than it had been in years. Here we are 2 years later, and it's gotten even higher. This is a risk, and it's a risk that we can do something about. A bunch of countries decided to at least identify and name the risk. You can't fix a problem unless you say what it is. And they did that. They also, in this visionary treaty, recognized that nuclear weapons affect humans. Okay, now there are nuclear weapon treaties, none of which talk about the impact of nuclear weapons on people. That sounds ridiculous. But it's up until now, it has been about the impact and the role of nuclear weapons in state-to-state security, state relations. But not where do people fit in the picture. And this treaty recognizes that nuclear weapons have had the production, development, testing, and use of nuclear weapons has had a disproportionate impact on indigenous communities around the world. That was pretty incredible. That took a lot of good work with some good allies. The treaty also recognizes that nuclear weapons have a disproportionate impact on women and girls because ionizing radiation affects our bodies differently. And all of the studies, all of the regulations, all of the standards are set on based on a 5'10", 165-pound male. And that is not what humanity looks like. It's certainly not what I look like. So this treaty recognizes, it's visionary about that. And it recognizes that there are other pieces to the whole puzzle around nuclear weapons. It's not, you know, this isn't a one-stop shop to fix every issue. This is part of the overall nuclear weapons regime in international law. It recognizes the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which, for all its flaws, at the least, you know, says you can't make new nuclear weapons by testing them. No explosive testing ever again. And that treaty hasn't yet entered into force. You can lobby your congresspeople about that. but it has, with one exception, stopped nuclear testing. It has built an international system of monitoring and verification that is the strongest and most technologically advanced in the world. If we had had this international system in the 60s, we would know if Israel and South Africa had blown up that test in the Indian Ocean. We know if it's an earthquake or a nuclear explosion. This international monitoring system, and I am not a shill for the CTBTO, okay, I want to make that clear. That treaty does have some problems. But this international monitoring system has helped us predict and give advance warning for severe weather events. It has saved lives from tsunamis. And that is an added bonus to a treaty that's designed to protect people from the effects of nuclear testing. Pretty cool. And it's one piece of that overall package, like the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. So in this treaty, I like to explain it very simply because treaty language is super boring. And I was in those basement conference rooms arguing about commas and semicolons. And I will tell you, that is not how I wish to have spent hours and hours of my life. But I did. I also drank a lot of coffee. The coffee was good. The end result of the treaty, I think, is also very good. And broadly, it makes it illegal to make, have, or use nuclear weapons. So the treaty also makes it illegal to help others make, have, or use nuclear weapons. This is super exciting for me, and I'll get to that in a minute. The treaty comes out of a new tradition that was started in the 90s, just like my anti-nuclear career. And it was started in the 90s, and it's this tradition that comes out of, that was started with the first treaty that prohibits anti-personnel landmines, right? The mine ban treaty, the Ottawa Convention, where people were put at the center. Humanitarian disarmament. Disarmament to prevent humanitarian harm. To prevent the kind of harm that you cannot mitigate through traditional humanitarian relief efforts. Humanitarian disarmament led us, as a global society, to make anti-personnel landmines banned, to make cluster bombs banned, and has led us to ban nuclear weapons. The next one on the list is killer robots. We can talk about that afterwards. So, like every treaty, this is part and parcel of international law, so it has, you know, your traditional international law provisions, like an entry into force provision. And this is pretty, pretty strict because people negotiating, Sweden, wanted this to be super, super strong. They said, we don't want it to make it easy to make this treaty come into effect. It has to be difficult. It has to mean something. What it means is that a little bit more than 25% of UN members have to accede to the treaty before it becomes international law. That's 50 countries. The treaty was first opened for signature and ratification in September of 2017. We're at 22 so far. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty in the same amount of time was at 3. So we're doing okay, and we're pushing really hard. We know it's in the legislature in El Salvador. We know that Brazil is on the way. South Africa, again, love South Africa. South African wine. South Africa is the first country that had nuclear weapons that has now joined this treaty, and they have ratified the treaty, and they're the most recent ratification. Very happy about that. So we're at 22, but we need to get 50. And that is a lot of work because treaty ratification is not an easy thing. It's not like going, you know, and signing a piece of paper. Well, for the Holy See, it was signing a piece of paper. You know, for the Kingdom of Thailand, the kings instructed the diplomats, yes, and here's our instrument of ratification. It was a bit easier, you know. But not every country has it so easy. A lot of countries, like this one, require a significant majority of parliament or senate here. It's a two-thirds majority, right? In the Dutch system, we also have two houses in our parliament, an upper house and a lower house. And the lower house has to recommend the treaty to the government. The government has to accept and say, yes, we agree with the recommendation and send it to the Senate, the upper house. And then the Senate has to also support it, not with a two-thirds majority, but it's going to take some work. We'll get there. We like campaigning. We'll do it. And once we get entry into force, that is when the treaty becomes effective international law. But it doesn't have to be entered into force to have an impact. And that's kind of a cool thing about treaties. Like, yes, you want them to enter into force because you want every single one of those provisions to come into effect. You want the victim assistance and environmental remediation clauses in this treaty to be in effect. Because when they are, every government that has signed onto this treaty will be responsible for helping everybody who has been affected by nuclear weapons. Now, I'm not saying everybody's getting money, right? We're not talking about compensation. not talking about handing out cash. What we're talking about is making sure that people have access to enjoy their full human rights. And that means access to education. It means you cannot stigmatize victims for being victims. And that's a big issue when it comes to nuclear weapons. As anyone who was in Hiroshima, even the second generation survivors from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, are still stigmatized. People don't want to marry them. You know, it says, oh, no, you're contaminated. And there's no redress. There's no place to go to say, hey, you know, this is a human rights issue as well. And it means that there has to be some help for the environment. Testing nuclear weapons messed up the planet. Okay, now there's a lot of things that have messed up the planet, and we have zero baseline information about what our planet, the one that we've got, was like before nuclear weapons were detonated in the atmosphere. We do not know what background radiation really is. We do know how to do some things that can help mitigate those effects. We do know how to do some things that can help protect people, that can isolate areas. We do not have the answers, but we do know that we can redirect resources into figuring out how to fix some of these problems and all of the other myriad problems that there are with the environment that also require actually a significant redirect of resources. So that's the treaty. I'm really excited. I love this treaty. And that's partly because it makes nuclear weapons illegal. Like, that's cool. and it was a moment of, you know, it's going to happen, but it's still total shock on that July day in another UN basement conference room when the treaty was adopted. And it was hugs and tears and cheers and people running through the room and diplomats jumping over tables to hug one another. And diplomats, you know, not very emotive, kind of trained not to be. You have to say some pretty harsh things sometimes, but people were proud to be part of this. So it was adopted in July 2017. In September, it opened for signature, which means that countries came and we had a big signing ceremony and countries lined up to, you know, the legal Office of Legal Affairs in the UN. They keep at least 6 pens because people accidentally leave and they come up and heads of state or deputized officials need to come and actually physically sign the same treaty. And it's a big book that looks like this. We went and visited our treaty in the Office of Legal. It's a big book, the official certified copy, and it has those signatures of heads of state. And states still continue signing it, which is really important because we need to get to 50. And usually the process is a signature followed by ratification. Some can do both at the same time. So this treaty, you know, once it's there, it's only going to be legally binding on the countries that join it. Okay, and that's quite tricky because when the negotiations started, the U.S. in particular organized a protest in front of the conference room and said, do not go into this room and negotiate this treaty. Actually, it was Nikki Haley, and she is not, doesn't have a voice like that at all. As much as she's from the South, she has a sweeter voice. But she still is very fierce and said, don't go in there. This treaty will never have an impact. Don't bother. And methinks she doth protest too much. Because why would you get six governments and a whole bunch of interns to stand in front of a conference room if a treaty is not going to have an impact? You just let it happen. Lots of negotiations go on every single day that nobody really cares about, or people do, but they just happen. She made a very big deal of this, and that was amazing for our campaign because we were struggling, because the press doesn't give a hoot about, you know, UN treaties. But when the US government organizes a boycott protest in the UN, whoa, major news. So thank you, Nikki Haley. Oh, that was great. And, you know, it really built up this issue, this treaty is going to have an impact because norms matter. And even when countries don't sign on to a treaty directly, they are still affected. Think about, again, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. That's a treaty, didn't enter into force, was negotiated, opened for signature in 1996, before I got started working on this issue. Not very much before. Anyway, it opened, and it needs a specific list of 44 countries to ratify it before it can enter into force, and they haven't. So it's not there. But what happened in 1998 when India and Pakistan tested nuclear weapons? Well, they were extremely harshly condemned. The Security Council placed massive sanctions on both India and Pakistan. They were shunned. Why? Because they violated a norm. When North Korea tested nuclear weapons first in 2006, the same thing again. Shunned, excluded from the international community, pushed aside. No, you cannot get your credentials for this conference. Yes, we are putting massive sanctions on you. Yes, you must come to the negotiating table and figure out a way to let inspectors into your country to dismantle your program. Not because they signed on to a treaty, but because the norm is there. The Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons gives a pathway for the norm against nuclear weapons to grow and be strengthened. And this, at this time, is so important. I'm watching the norm on nuclear weapons erode in a few places. And I want to make it clear, because I sit in a much different chair than you all are sitting in here. My view, sitting in, you know, my nice office in the Netherlands, is a different one. And it's one where we are seeing Russia encroaching onto other countries' territory and taking it by force. It's one where there's a culture of fear that is growing and growing and growing, and we are worried about our security. We are worried about a superpower rivalry between the US and Russia like we haven't seen since the Cold War. And most of my colleagues were not around in the Cold War. And the few people who work, there's a community of people who work on nuclear weapons issues, and some of us were around in the Cold War, and a lot of us were not. And throughout our campaign, I mean, ICAN is an international campaign that involves 538 partners in 103 countries. All right, so in the Cold War, not all of those countries were really affected. They were doing some other things. Our partners in Cote d'Ivoire don't really care about a Cold War rivalry. Our partners in Cote d'Ivoire want to see their country ratify the treaty because it is a security benefit to have all the countries in the region sign on. Then you don't have these tensions. Then everybody just says, no, it's a dumb weapon, we're moving beyond it. It's a big, clumsy bomb that is designed to destroy cities and violate international humanitarian law, and that is not acceptable for us. So there's this split. Now, those countries that have nuclear weapons, those nine countries, are all looking for ways to modernize their arsenals. They're looking for ways to, and I quote, if we have them, why can't we use them? And figure out ways to get rid of the taboo against the use of nuclear weapons, the taboo that has stood since 1945. That taboo is eroding. So what happens when a taboo goes away? Well, you build it up again with law, and you need multiple layers. And this treaty is giving us an opportunity to do so. And in countries like the Netherlands that do not have their own nuclear weapons, but host American nuclear weapons, we have a squadron of fighter pilots that are trained and at the ready to drop American bombs. In our country, though, we also have a very, very healthy democracy. And nuclear weapons represent a democratic deficit. And let me explain. No single country in the world that has nuclear weapons ever offered its citizens a choice in the matter. And there are ways to affect the choices that get made around nuclear weapons. There are ways, for example, to go after the funding. In the United States, the current estimated expenditure on nuclear weapons is $1.7 trillion over the next 30 years. I do not understand what $1.7 trillion looks like. I do understand what $70,000 a minute looks like. $70,000 a minute, every day, every week, every month, for 30 years. So diversion of resources away from building new nuclear weapons into cleaning up the mess from nuclear weapons, finding good ways to safely and verifiably disarm those weapons, dealing with some other things that are going on, like critical infrastructure, energy security, preventing cyber attacks. These are things that you could spend that money on. I'm just saying. We're having a big debate about whether or not we should buy a specific type of new fighter plane that would be used to drop nuclear bombs in the Netherlands. And it is a big, heated debate. But it's only like 15 people that are really involved in it that actually make the decisions. Because when it comes to decision making, it is not a huge number of people. It's just finding the right person in the right moment and sitting next to them in church and having a chat. Or, if your kids go to daycare together. No, I'm just kidding. Don't stalk people. I'm not advocating that. I am advocating ways, though, to engage with anyone who's interested in the nuclear weapons issue. And throughout our campaign, we're looking to build up the stigma against nuclear weapons, to build up the perception, to remind people, yes, there is a problem. But just because there's a problem doesn't mean that there's no solution. I remember when I first started doing this kind of thing, I remember sitting in a congressional office in Washington and being told, who are you to talk about this? You do not have a PhD in physics. Why should I believe you? And it is true, I do not have a PhD in physics. What I am is a concerned person, and I have every right to talk about this issue. I have every right to challenge a democratic process to make sure that I am safe, that money that comes out of my pocket is not going for this. We got the Nobel Peace Prize in October of 2017. Whew, let me tell you, that was crazy. Because we thought we were getting a call like 15 minutes before. I mean, we knew we were nominated, right? A couple hundred people get nominated. We knew we were up on the list. We all thought it was going to be Federica Mogherini and the EU and the, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. We kind of hoped it was going to be around nukes. We thought it was going to be around the Iran deal. So we got the call. We were expecting it 15 minutes before. It actually came 5 minutes before. So we were like, nothing. We sent out a message. We didn't get the call at, 12 minutes before it got announced. Yeah, a little preemptive. And then we all shut off the ringers on the notifications on our phones because they went off the hook because we won a Nobel Peace Prize. And I threw my phone at a member of the Dutch Ministry of Foreign Affairs because I didn't believe it. And I swore and I said, you need to check this right now. And he went, oh, okay, we both need to do stuff. And then we ran out of the meeting we were at. Yeah, it was an exciting moment. I'll never forget it. And neither will he. He didn't have a bruise. But it happened, and we were totally shocked. And what one of the things that we were shocked by, and one of the things in talking to the Nobel Committee, it was very clear. We got this. There's a list. We got it for bringing attention to the catastrophic humanitarian consequences of any use of nuclear weapons, and our help in facilitating the negotiation for the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. That's why. That was the official reason. But you know, you talk to Birgitta, you talk to the Nobel Committee, and they're like, yeah, actually, we just gave you a challenge. This is not a gold watch. This is not a congratulations. Yes, you did a good job, but now you have to do more. And you have to do a lot more. So we are giving you a tool to get this treaty into force and to get the world to understand that the challenge of nuclear weapons is not impossible. That movements matter, that we as people around the world, all of us, can and do change the world we live in. That's why we got the Nobel Prize. It was to do more work. And it has created a lot more work, but also not in a bad way, in the kind of way where now I can go and say, hey, Deb, I'm going to be coming to Salt Lake City, or I could come to Salt Lake City. Do you think we could do something with the city council? We've got this I Can Save pledge. You know, you can, as a member of I Can, do you think that we could partner up and do something cool? Because I can bring the prize with me, and maybe that would help. And I did. I'm so scared I'm gonna drop it. And I did. And so last night, we were at the city council here in Salt Lake City. And the city council overwhelmingly and spiritedly adopted the most progressive resolution coming out of the United States so far. And this resolution supports the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, and it stigmatizes nuclear weapons, and that is our job. And it was so cool, and so thank you.
You were listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be back in a minute. You were listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. On this program, we record and broadcast many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. We replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. And today we are featuring a lecture delivered by Nobel Peace Prize winner Susie Snyder on her efforts advocating for abolishing nuclear weapons.
That's not the only thing we're doing to build this stigma. Cities are so important because global issues matter at the local level. And we have to connect with our neighbors. We have to connect within our community. And going through cities is necessary to build up the understanding that this is unacceptable. Spending $70,000 a minute on nuclear weapons, nuh-uh. Done. We got to stop. We have other things we can do with that money. But it's not just governments that are kind of involved in the money game around nuclear weapons. And it's not just through governments that we're building the pressure to make sure that nuclear weapons are unacceptable, that they are recognized as illegitimate. A lot of the work I do these days is talking to banks and talking to pension funds and talking to endowment communities and committees and universities. And what we're doing is we're asking them to put in a policy that says they will not invest in the companies that produce nuclear weapons. So since the treaty came into effect, you know, this is so quantifiable, this work. I love it because for the first time in my life, I can write grant reports and give numbers. It's like amazing. It's so quantifiable because we do the research and we say, okay, how many policies can we find against investment? And in the year from the treaty's adoption until the first year, that number of policies against investment went up. And it went from 56 to 63, which doesn't sound like a lot. But these are policies of banks like BNP Paribas that operates in 73 countries. These are policies in banks like HSBC. These are policies in tiny pension funds like the Metal Workers Union in the Netherlands, which has a really, really good policy. These are policies like the Norwegian State Pension Fund, which is the richest pension fund in the world. And they will not invest in companies associated with the production of nuclear weapons. And that is really cool because that is, I think they're valued at like $1.3 trillion right now. That's a lot of money that's not going to these companies. And they told them why. And that's super important. So the policies are going up. This year, when we publish the report, it's so much work. We're going to get it out soon. When we publish the report, we're going to see those numbers go up more. Why? Because people are now contacting us to say, hey, we have a policy. We want to be included. Hey, we're doing this investment. It's a church. Can we also be included? The Methodist Pension Fund in the United States, Westpath, is actually, they're looking really good this year. We're hoping to get them in our Hall of Fame. Still have to do a couple of checks, but they're looking great. So policies demonstrate stigma. But of course it's a numbers game. And so we have to say how much money, how many banks and pension funds are actually investing. And between 2017 and 2018, the number of financial institutions with investments in companies associated with the production of nuclear weapons went down by 10%. My donor was very happy. I was probably very much more happy. This is significant. A 10% drop means that there is now starting to be that bubble. There's discussions. And in almost every country, there are these sustainable investment forums. You know, corporate social responsibility is like a thing. Since the 2008 financial crisis, more and more pension funds, banks are looking for socially responsible investment. They're looking for ways to make money and not do harm. Millennial investors right now, biggest new group coming in, both inherited and earned wealth, and they are demanding funds that do not contribute to carbon, that do not contribute to deforestation, that do not contribute to the production of weapons. This is so cool. And this is going to keep growing. And I'm confident that when we publish our report this year, we'll see that number go down some more because of pressure. Because nothing happens magically. Nothing. Everything happens because somebody asked somebody to do something. The only people who get stuff to happen for them without asking are little kids. You know? And even then, it's not always great. So we ask people to do this. We ask people, if you, for example, have e-banking on your phone, to send your bank a message and say, do you have a policy against investing in nuclear weapon producers? You can do that now. Oh, actually, your phone's on silent, so maybe not. But it's an easy, easy, easy thing to do. You can walk into your local bank branch and just ask, does this bank have a policy? And they won't know. So ask them to get back to you. And that starts a conversation up the chain. And we held a global day of action targeting BNP Paribas last year. Because again, they operate in 74 countries. And they have investments in nuclear weapon producers. And they have a policy that says they'll only invest in the companies producing nuclear weapons for France, the UK, and the US. And we're like, well, go a little bit further. They market themselves as a bank for a changing world. Well, we ask them to change the world a little bit more. We're still talking to them. On the day of action, they knew we were going to do this, because we told them, and they sent an email to 177,000 employees around the world to explain that BNP Paribas does not support the production of nuclear weapons, because the production of nuclear weapons is a problem. That's how it started. And then it went on to give them talking points if they're confronted by campaigners, and, you know, because that's how it goes. And they were asked, and they have answered. Now we're continuing the conversation. Is BNP Paribas going to be a good guy on all issues? No. No, but they are going to change on this because we ask, because people ask, because ordinary campaigners around the world asked. A elementary school class in the Philippines went to their local BNP with letters and balloons and asked them to, you know, meet with the manager, and that they asked. In Toronto, a group of people came in and they went, there's three different branch offices, and they hit everyone that day with just a letter. Hey, we'd like you to do this. It was beautiful. In Malaysia, I don't quite know how they did it. They hired a plane that had a banner trailing off of it that said, no nukes. BNP, change the game. That was really cool. I'm not asking anybody to do that. That was a surprise. They weren't even on our action list. They just sent us photos. We're like, what? Super cool. But we ask, and there's always something you can do. So we have some things in the campaign. The city resolution, as you've heard. We also encourage you, it's called Don't Bank on the Bomb. You want to find out more? You want to find out where your bank fits on that list? Check it out, don'tbankonthebomb.com. If you work in the STEM field, or if you know others who work in the STEM field, there's a new push for new technologies integrating into nuclear weapons. And this is terribly risky, and it will involve a lot of effort from those within the STEM field. So we have launched a STEM pledge, and we're asking those who work in that field to take the pledge. It's at nuclearban.org. Take the pledge that your work, you will do everything you can to make sure your work does not contribute to a weapon designed to destroy cities. And we also, of course, because parliaments matter, like Senate, Congress, state legislature, all of these can help build the stigma. So we have parliamentary pledge. And we ask people who are elected officials to sign the pledge, to say that they will do what they can in this season, in the next season, when the time is right, to at least get on board with us now to do this. And then we ask them if we can take a picture and we share it on social media. Why? Because the internet never goes away. And if your picture is out there saying you will do what you can to stop nuclear weapons, you will do what you can to support the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons, well, that's going to last forever. And we will not forget. And we'll keep reminding people and asking them to come back. So our ambition is to get nuclear weapons out of the world. We got the Nobel Prize as a challenge to help us do it. And we're on the way. But we can't do it alone. And so I have an ask. We have here a local partner, UCAN, Utah Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. And I ask you to find out how you can help our local partner, because that is how we are going to do this together. Thank you.
And you were listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be back. You were listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the local shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. This is Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. In this final segment, Ms. Snyder takes questions from the audience of faculty and students.
Okay, so we've all been working on this issue here too for a long time. What do we do with our current administration to push this?
Great question. Sometimes you need to pick your battles. Okay? So in this administration, there are still good people in the administration. And I want to make that clear. There are. The U.S. is leading something called the International Consortium on Nonproliferation Disarmament Verification. And yeah, it's a big, long mouthful, and it's an acronym that I have never gotten correct. It's on verification. It's on verification of how do you make sure when you dismantle a nuclear weapon that you've actually done it. And how do you do that without giving away the secrets of how a nuclear weapon is made? This is tricky. I mean, it really is tricky. And the U.S. is actually spearheading the effort on research around that. And that is a positive thing coming out of the U.S. administration. Now, it's not done in the intent to dismantle all of the U.S. weapons. Not right now. The reason it's done is to prepare the groundwork for future dismantlement. But that kind of work also needs to happen. So find the positives. Now, other things in the administration suck. Sorry, radio listeners. But they really do. And, you know, so don't butt your head against a wall that's just going to give you bruises. Instead, look for openings where you can find them. There is a new generation of congresspeople in the U.S. Congress. It is amazing. Like, I'm watching this from afar, and I am such an AOC fan. Oh, so good. But why isn't diversion away from nuclear weapons spending part of a plan to fund the Green New Deal? $70,000 a minute. It's a lot. You could do cool things. And we're reaching out to her office to try to build this up and try to get it in there. But there's going to be, like, as things move towards the next election cycle, like yesterday, right? American politics, you know, it's like an election every minute. it's worse than Belgium. But as it moves to the new election cycle, why not ask the candidates? Why not demand from the media outlets? What's the plan? Why aren't the debates? There's going to be Democratic candidate debates everywhere, right? Because there's like 500,000 people running. So where are they on this issue? Who's doing ranking around this? There are organizations that put out these, you know, scorecards. Are they including nuclear weapons? Are you a member of one of those organizations, like Sierra Club or something like that, right? Don't they put out this kind of thing? Why not ask? Again, we don't get anything without asking. And we can sometimes ask over and over and still not get it, but one day we do. And we just gotta keep going. And it's hard sometimes. And I'm not gonna lie, it is depressing and boring and sucks sometimes. But then, you know, you drink some coffee and you go for a walk and it's really pretty here. So I don't know how many of you ski. I don't, but I would. And, you know, you kind of take a look and you take a pause, take a break from it, and you come back. Because you can always come back. That's the cool thing about campaigning. You can walk away for a while, go do some other stuff, and then come back. And in my experience with campaigners, you're always welcome. And I love it. Is there other questions?
Would you address, I guess I have this personal dilemma about what's the biggest issue, climate change. I mean, climate change and nuclear weapons, it isn't
both
either or.
Threats.
We have to do both. But just address that.
Yeah, they're both
existential
threats.
There's two pressing
threats.
Needs that are so essential for our survival.
That is absolutely true. And both climate and nuclear weapons are existential. And nuclear weapons are easier to fix. I'm not going to lie. It's just the easier problem. And where to put your energy is a challenge that every single one of us deals with every day. And, you know, I go to the climate march, you know, I go to the women's march. I put my volunteer energy into women's organizations because I believe that women's human rights are human rights. But you gotta figure out what's best for you. Both things matter. And I'm not gonna say to prioritize one over the other. Find other people. For everything you go to, get somebody who doesn't do something on this to split their time and do the other. Bring another person in. And there's two. Makes it a little easier. And, you know, I wouldn't have been doing this if somebody hadn't said to me, hey, do you want to do this? Right? You got to ask. and then you'll get there. I think I'll... Oh, we got one more question right here.
So if we, like, pretty much destroy a nuclear weapon and scrap it into part, is there, like, a positive way we could use those nuclear waste into, like, a positive solution, like making energies or... Like, in a non-destructive way, like bombing people.
Yeah, well, I'm always a fan of non-destructive recycling. there's a really cool company called Beer Not Bombs out of, I think, Southern California that takes old parts from dismantled ICBMs and turns it into bottle openers and other jewelry. Like, that's kind of a cool thing, but it's sort of a niche market. And how many bottle openers does any person really need? Hint, hint, Christmas gifts. but in terms of, so there's parts of a nuclear weapon, right? So you have your, whatever it uses to deliver, the missile or so on, unless it's a gravity bomb. And there are pieces you can kind of put into other stuff. It's metal. Metal you can put into other things. The actual nuclear components, that's a question. And I did a report, an analysis a few years back, we called it a cost-benefit analysis of recycling nuclear weapons into nuclear energy. Now, I'm not a big fan of nuclear energy. I'm going to make that clear. Pulling uranium out of the ground is a bad idea. It contaminates communities and it hurts people. What I figured out, though, you know, just again playing with math, because I like math, is that if you took all of the nuclear components out of the existing nuclear arsenals and put them and converted them for use in nuclear energy reactors, you could stop the uranium market now. You'd have enough fuel for 3 years, which could give you enough time to do an energy conversion into alternatives. That was our pitch in our cost-benefit analysis. Because again, you have to look at numbers. You have to put creative things out there. So there are things you can do. There are. It was a significant part of the Russian arsenal. Russia and the US had massive arsenals. There were 70,000 nukes. And there was this program that took old Russian warheads into the US and then converted the nuclear material to nuclear energy. And that is part of the fuel that was used in the southeastern US for a decade. Yeah, it's kind of a thing. But there, again, lots of problems with nuclear energy, lots and lots of problems with nuclear energy. I don't want to open that door at this moment. And this is a campaign. We talk about nuclear weapons all the time. But there are things, there are definitely ways to get out of it and to convert. And when it comes to the scientific challenges, I want to make it clear, if you study applied physics, there are not always so many places you can go with that knowledge. And there's a huge enticement by the nuclear weapons industry. Come on, come work on this stuff. The challenges are really cool. Shoot a bullet with a bullet. Yeah, it's cool. And it is really interesting. But the real challenge is, how are we going to deal with the material that we've made? Where is it going to go? How are we going to protect the environment for thousands of years? And that is a new challenge that I think these brilliant minds could put some more thought into.
Susie, you mentioned Europe and the heightening tensions there. Do you think there's a possibility that the European nations that house U.S. nukes could be rallied to say it's too dangerous for us to have these nukes now that the tensions are coming up? Here, take them back. And we want them out of Europe.
Well, I'll tell you, it is something we are working on. there's a modernization process, and there are new bombs that are coming to replace the. There's about 200, 180 stored throughout Europe in five different countries. And they're all in this new modernization process. The bomb is called the B-61. And we currently have 3s and 4s and 11s. And after 2024, we're going to be getting 12s. And in the U.S., after 2046, I think it is, the U.S. is going to start making 13s, right? Which we're really not interested in, I'll tell you. It's difficult. Nuclear weapons, there is a democratic deficit, because the Dutch parliament has said repeatedly, we do not want these nuclear weapons here. In fact, when I first came onto this project, there was a resolution in the parliament that instructed the government to say that the Dutch are no longer want to be under the U.S. nuclear umbrella. And we got reports back that that was conveyed through the ambassador in Washington to the United States government, but that it wasn't a decision that we could take alone, that our sovereignty was gone on this issue because it had to be decided within NATO as a whole. By consensus. I am an activist who loves consensus. I have also seen the abuse of consensus in international relations consistently for decades. We were told it has to be a NATO consensus decision. This is not, not right. So what we're doing now is we're just making it overwhelming. 86% of Norwegians, Norway's part of NATO, want Norway to join the nuclear ban treaty, no matter what it means to NATO. Norway already has national legislation that is like pretty much in line with the treaty anyway. It wouldn't change that much. But they'd have to stop signing up. They'd have to have an asterisk in NATO joint declarations, a little thing that says Norway no longer aligns itself with the policy that NATO is a nuclear alliance. We're getting more people pushing to get more countries to join in that little asterisk group, because those eventually become a majority and the whole thing changes. I think it's possible. I'm 100% convinced it is possible. I'm 100% convinced that nuclear weapons will be eliminated in my lifetime, you know, despite this speech 10 years ago in Prague. And it will take people putting their energy to it. And it'll take people going, oh no, we have to, because the risks are getting so high. And this morning, I had the worst breakfast because I was reading a paper around cyber risks and nuclear weapons. And I will tell you, if you want to diet, you can think about, you know, reading some of these things, because they are terrifying. And I was like, oh, I can't eat anymore. Made me a little bit, the risks are getting higher and higher. And how do you deal with a risk? You take away the threat. Here, it's going to be easier than climate change. Getting rid of existential threats is good for everyone. So pick your passion and go for it. We can all do something. Thanks.
That's Nobel Peace Prize winner Susie Snyder speaking at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on April 3rd, 2018. The title of today's forum was Noble Ambitions, Nobel Prize, and looked at the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons. If you'd like to hear the full talk, as well as other Hinckley forums, you can find them on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund, and this forum was co-sponsored by the Tenor Center for Human Rights and the Utah Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. I'm Christian Camargo, producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.